sabrosura pa ti que.
Hello everyone, this is Pam de Café con Pam, the bilingual podcast that features Latine and people of the global majority who break barriers, change lives, and make this world a better place. Welcome to episode 341 of Café con Pam. Today, we have a conversation with Professora Natalia Molina. Natalia Molina is a distinguished professor of American Studies and Ethnicity and Dean's Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. Her research explores the interconnected histories of race, place, gender, culture, and citizenship. She's the author of three award-winning books, How Race is Made in America, Immigration, Citizenship, and the Historical Power of Racial Scripts, Fit to be Citizens, Public Health and Race in Los Angeles, 1879 through 1940, and most recently, A Place at the Nayarit, How a Mexican Restaurant Nourished a Community, which LA Times calls an essential LA book. Professor Molina is also a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians and an elected member of the Society of American Historians. She has given lectures in Latin America, Asia, Europe, as well as over 30 of the 50 United States. In 2018, she was the Organization of American Historians China Residency Scholar. A certified mediator, she enjoys opportunities for intellectual and cultural exchange, whether in the classroom, lecture hall, or over a restaurant table. Listeners, as you can hear, talking to Professor Molina, I mean, it was intimidating, but it was actually quite fun because she's really personable and open with her stories. And I really loved how she explores how history is made, basically, and how every aspect of a community, every human that forms part of a community, also is part of that history. And it's awesome to have someone who is in academia and writing those books. And it was such an honor to have a conversation with her. And I frankly could have stayed talking to her for a long time, asking questions. And now I want to take one of her lectures because she's awesome. Y bueno, sin más, here's my conversation with Natalia Molina. Welcome to Café con Pam, Professor Natalia Molina. How are you? ¿Cómo estás?
I'm great. It's wonderful to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm so excited to dive into our conversation because you have so much work that you've created, done, and we'll see where this takes us. We're having cafecito.
Sounds great. Yes.
So the first question that we always ask is, what is your heritage?
I am, on my mom's side, third generation Mexican-American. On my dad's side, second generation. And I say that because I really have both experiences of, you know, knowing what it's like to have the privileges of citizenship and the cultural capital that comes with being third gen, as well as I know what it means to be expected to be a good immigrant daughter. And translate for my family and all that. And also, I think of myself as Chicana. I went to UCLA. I was a women's studies major, but I took a lot of Chicano studies courses. And I think of myself as Latina because that term evolved as well. So I think of myself as all of these things.
I love that. And maybe we can dissect them because there are so many layers.
Yes. And context specific and all of that. Mm-hmm. I don't think of myself as Latinx, and yet I use the term because I think it's important to really embrace non-binary gender identities and gender fluidity. And when I'm with my students, nobody thinks twice about that. But if you post that on social media, it's almost like you're lighting a torch for people to come say grumpy things.
Totally. And given that you've done so much research and your work is in identity and all of that, why do you think there's so much dialogue, I don't know, discussion, controversy around the term Latinx? What have you found?
I mean, everybody has a right to say what they want, and I welcome it from people who have a genuine interest around Latino identity, Latino empowerment, Latino communities, Latino stories, Latino voices, and they take an issue with that. And then, and we always have a great conversation. What I don't like, and this is what I meant by grumpy people on social media, is when it's clearly people that this is the only issue that they talk about, and it's coming out of more of a conservative backlash to say, see, Latinos are doing it wrong. Latinos think that they are addressing the needs of the community, when in reality, it's only a small percentage that would identify as Latinx. But, you know, that's a very different conversation than, you know, my parents don't use that term, so why are we using it?
Totally. Yeah, it's very layered. But let's go back to your story and go, we're going to go back into memory lane. So you mentioned that you're third gen on one side, second gen on the other. You grew up in LA and your parents were together?
No.
Okay. So you got to experience the first, the second, and the third gen separately. So that's how it's like delineated very clearly.
Yes, as well as my aunts are first gen. And I was very much raised by my aunts.
How come?
Because my mom was a divorced mother who ran her own business. So she was just always working.
Was she at the restaurant?
Always at the restaurant. Holidays, birthdays, it was not uncommon to celebrate them later, like weeks later, or even not at all, or celebrate them at the restaurant, which meant that I spent a lot of weekends sleeping over my aunt's homes.
And they were older or younger than your mom?
They're all younger. My mom is the only one who's second gen and the eldest. So what I try to remind myself is also she's the cool cousin, right? She's the one that when they would immigrate to the U.S. would take them out. When they turned 21, would take them to a bar, would teach them how to order something like a Tom Collins.
Ooh.
You know, you carry all those selves of you inside of you, kind of like nesting dolls, like Sandra Cisneros writes about in The House on Mango Street. And it's so clear that that is who she is to them. So now that she's 90, my mom's 90, they look out for her.
I love that.
Yeah. And it's, you could tell it's not like any sense of obligation or duty in a negative way. It very much is like, she looked out for us.
I love that.
Yeah, our communities change.
So you were born already and the restaurant existed.
Yes. Yes.
So you basically...
I came into that world.
Yeah.
I basically went from the hospital into a red leather booth, you know. So my mom has all these stories about her carrying me like in a little backpack, like a little baby backpack, being a hostess, seating people. And then one of the waitresses would come up eventually and say, she's asleep now. And they'd put me to sleep in one of the little round, like pleather, dark red booths. And there I would sleep until the restaurant closed and we were ready to go home.
And you're an only child? Or did your mom?
No, I grew up with my brother, David, who was 5.5 years older than me.
Older.
Yes. Yes.
So you're born into the restaurant. Let's talk about how this restaurant happened. So grandma came in from Nayarit.
Yes. She came in to Los Angeles in 1921 on the heels of the Mexican Revolution. That is not an unusual story. That is a time of increased immigration from Mexico. People are fleeing the revolution and there are jobs in the Southwest. And they're recruiting Mexicans. You know, there are large-scale agricultural projects because water systems have now been developed. There are railroads and railways and urban rail lines that need to be built. There are buildings that need to be built and bricks that need to be created. All of this. And so Mexicans were very much desired in the American Southwest. What was unusual was for it to be a woman who came. And so she had been married to someone in the service, and she eventually left. And we don't know much of that story because she passed before I was born. And people think, oh, well, then you could interview people. Well, there are topics that are taboo. So nobody really knows the story there. But she knew how to cook. She cooked when he was in the service, she was a cook. And she decided to open her own restaurant here. And it took a couple decades, but eventually she did. And the largest one of the restaurants was called the Nayarit. And she opened it on Sunset in Echo Park.
And so then your mom, Loredo, by way of, it's the family business.
Yes. My mom is so built for a restaurant, public facing business. She doesn't know how to cook still, but she,
what?
Yes, because she was always front of house. That was what made the restaurant successful. My grandmother was back of house, quality control, trained every cook. Employees there went on to open their own restaurants that if they were related or fictive kin, that she might even help out with seed money. But my mother was all about front of house, making sure you not only did you never need anything, but before you could even think of needing something, she would take care of it. To the point that, again, my mom's 90 years old and we can go to a restaurant in LA today and there's invariably a busboy, a waiter, a bartender, a hostess who either worked at the restaurant or whose family worked at the restaurant, and they light up when they see her.
I love that.
Everyone loves that when you go to a restaurant and you're recognized and people treat you as if you belong and, like your family, and it feels nice to be an insider. It's also important to remember the context of the 50s and 60s in Los Angeles, that really it was a political act to smile at people. As it is, if you're Latino, you still might walk into a restaurant and wonder, like, are they ignoring us? Mm-hmm. Wait, didn't those people arrive after us? Mm-hmm. Is really the only table left by the kitchen, across in the bathroom, underneath this air conditioning vent, and I am now cold? You still wonder those things. So for them to create this space where the atmosphere was welcoming, the food was delicious, and the pretty lady who greeted you at the door remembered your name and asked you how your family was, like, wow. In an LA that was still racially segregated. And we also don't think of Los Angeles in this way. We think, oh, right, segregation, that's something that happened in the South. That's something that was mainly relegated, African-Americans suffered under. You could talk about this for any marginalized group. And in LA, what it meant was things like, for Mexicans, they couldn't go to the public pool unless it was the day before it was being cleaned and they were going to drain it. They couldn't sit where they wanted to in a theater. They attended segregated schools. Our first desegregation case is Mendez versus Westminster in 1947. That's, trying to desegregate schools.
Yeah.
So, there's so many ways in which the value of a space like a restaurant where people can go and feel welcome, it's huge.
It was a radical act to have a gathering space. And it makes me think of the concept of third space or the third home. Have you heard of it?
Yes, absolutely.
And so I think of when I read about the restaurant and what it provided and hearing the stories about the employees or the families of that recognize your mom and how it's been this trickle effect, and even hearing, how people were helped and in all those ways, this restaurant in a way became a third home for people.
Yes, very much. And at a time that it was very much needed, she opens it in 1951 and the book looks at the restaurant until she passes in 1969. So I'm mainly covering the 1950s and 60s. And this is a time when there's more migration of women and more families, but it's still dominated by men, single men, men without their families. And so it was that third space that people would go to work and then stop by the restaurant on the way home, maybe have a beer, maybe have a taco, but just as importantly, run into someone that they may know or that they could hear Spanish being spoken and they could turn their head and strike up a conversation. And especially at a time where these were single men, they were likely living in a boarding house, maybe not as accepted or had such a community. So these kinds of spaces were integral.
And I mean, I wonder at the time how many of those places existed, you know, that people embraced El Nayarit so much.
Absolutely. Not many. There were Mexican restaurants by this point. Los Angeles has had a long history of Mexican food, whether it be you're talking about the late 1800s with the area we now think of as Alvera Street, where that was a place where laborers would gather before going off to their jobs. And there would be tamale carts, and maybe they would sell atoles. So, you know, really heavy food that would really brace you for the day. And there are some restaurants in LA that have been in existence, very few, but there are some that have been in existence for 100 years, Mexican restaurants like El Cholo, that were also family owned. Those restaurants really found their footing in catering to an Anglo audience. So when you think of things that we all love, things like a taco enchilada combo plate with the refried greens and that yellow cheese that gets hard under the heat lamp, and a nice, you know, salty margarita with the rim, you know, the salt rim, and it's just so good. But it's almost ubiquitous, mm-hmm. right? The whole appeal of that food is that it's somewhat uniform, generic in a good way. Because again, I love that food and I am a fan of some of these restaurants. But the appeal of it was that we would Americanize it and make it palatable. Whereas the food that my grandmother sold at her restaurant, the Nayarit, she had some of that, to be sure. She was trying to attract a diverse audience, but she was also doing regional food, food that spoke of her authenticity. She was not trying to assimilate as a person, and she was not trying to assimilate her food. And it was her kind of calling card of, look at Mexican culture. It is unique and specific. And it, for the people who are familiar with it, they will connect with it and they will take regional and national pride in sharing their food with you.
I love that. Did you, as you were writing this book, and I know you're writing another one, which we'll talk about, but as you were writing this book, did you ever wonder, or like, have you, do you, did you ask your mom? I don't know, so many questions. Where the strength came from refusing the assimilation in such trying times where I've seen the signs where it's like, no Mexicans or dogs allowed. And, you know, like, how did she stay grounded into, this is what I'm going to do, regardless of whatever?
That's a great question. And I did not get great answers as I was doing oral interviews. And so I started doing a lot of research on oral histories and when there are silences in oral histories. Mm. And part of it is, you know, that generation really leaning into, that's just how we did it. You know, that they didn't see that they had a choice, that they were here to make sacrifices, that the reward would be in the next generation. Mm. You know, which is why there's also so much pressure when you're second gen as well, right? Like, oh my gosh, our families did so much for us. We must live up to these expectations.
Right. Have you had this conversation with your mom? Like, what pressures do you feel with this legacy that she, like, grandma left?
Yeah. Can you imagine? I mean, that look, like, pressure, you go to school. You didn't have to work your whole life, all day, every day, 7 days a week, you know, 14 hours a day. What are you talking about?
Yes. That's what I was thinking. I'm like, did she just literally put one foot in front of the next and was like, this is just the way that we do this?
Yeah. I mean, look at my mom's life. She has a unique story in that she was born during the Depression and her mom contracts tuberculosis and knows that she's going to pass. And so she asked my grandmother to adopt her children because she knows she's going to pass. And so my grandmother is my mom's adopted mom.
Wow.
And this is particularly striking during the Depression, because during the Depression, this is when, you know, Mexicans are being socially, economic, culturally scapegoated, right? They're not here for the jobs anymore. And since their existence is to be as workers, that's what their acceptance relies on, then if they're not going to be working, then they are no longer needed here. And so the U.S. starts these repatriation programs in which Mexicans are highly encouraged to leave the U.S., and which the U.S. government will even pay for them to leave, like pay their train fare, you know, really encouraging them to go. And when we say many chose to go, I mean, really, what choice did they have? There were no jobs here. People were stigmatizing them. And so many went back. But many of the ones that went back were American citizens, because they were youth, they were children, they were under 18. They really had no choice but to go back with their families. And so had my grandmother not adopted them, perhaps my mother would have been, and her brother would have been, some of those Mexican Americans who were repatriated back to, or I can't say back, right? They were born here, were repatriated to Mexico.
Wow.
They escaped that, and then they go into World War II. And so they live with rations. My grandmother worked, and you know, was also a single mom. So she sent both kids, both my mother and her brother, to boarding school, to religious boarding school, so that she could work during the week. And then my mother would come home on the weekends, and at 9 years old would help in the restaurant. So it's also that context of what people went through during their formative years is really important. You know, for my students, it's a much different story now because their parents are younger, right? But my students have these stories of, you know, grandparents being in the Bracero program, the guest worker program between U.S. and Mexico that runs from, you know, 1942 to 1964, where basically, again, we accept Mexicans as workers. So we say, hey, come on over and do this labor for 6 months, 1 year at a time, then we'll send you back to Mexico. And then we'll bring you back. And there are people that did that for like 20 years and lived their majority of their life in the U.S., but were not accepted as citizens. You know, just we can, you know, go decade by decade with this.
And there's so many layers to it, 100%. So to bring it back to you, you're born in the restaurant. Your mom is front of the house. Your grandma's back of the house. You were born when she had already passed.
Yes.
So your mom is in charge of the restaurant. As you grow into the restaurant. How do you decide to go to school and not just take over the restaurant?
Well, eventually my mother sold the restaurant. Her and my grandmother were a team. And without that team, it wasn't really feasible. She thought that she could, until she even tried opening a different restaurant on her own, and it didn't work out. And so in some ways, it's a sad story, and you know, people still lament the restaurant. In other ways, your question to me is so spot on. I think maybe I would have never become a professor had we kept the restaurant, because even as a small child, I loved it. I loved seeing the people. I loved the food. I ate there all the time. you know, just the community, the way in which people were happy being in that space, and you wanted to make them happy. So there was so much that I loved about it that without the restaurant closing, we may not be having this interview.
Maybe it would be a different one. I don't know.
A very different one. Yes. All the lives we can lead.
Right. When was the restaurant sold? What year?
In 1976.
So women in 1974, women couldn't have their own bank account until 1974. And so your grandmother owned a whole ass restaurant before women could technically officially have their own money. And then she passed it on to your mom, which owned it even before women officially could. So how was it for, have you talked to her about this, for her to make the decision to sell, to like go through that process in such times where it was still not only the racial times, but also as a woman dealing with that type of business transaction?
You know, so much of their decisions were and motivations were about for the community. And so much about the restaurant was about bringing in family members, fictive kin, friends of family to work at the restaurant. And it wasn't that my grandmother had anything against somebody being undocumented, but the restaurant afforded her the possibility to help people immigrate with papers because she was a business sponsor and she hired an attorney. And so everybody that came with a green card. It meant that if they wanted to go back to Mexico for a period, they could. And then when they wanted to return, they could. It meant that they could receive Social Security. It meant that they could open their own businesses. And it meant that they could also become citizens if they wished. Though very few of them did, which is very much in keeping with the time period.
Mm-hmm.
After 1965, the immigration laws change. There's the 1965 Immigration Act, and there's a lot less opportunities for immigrating people legally. And so I think also that need of thinking about the family as a whole, the community as a whole, it wasn't as urgent. And so as my mom's life changed and she had children and she got married, that kind of urgency wasn't there, especially with her main partner, my grandmother, who was really the head of the operation. With her passing in 1969.
For sure. Makes sense. Let's take a quick coffee break. This is a good time. Okay. So do you drink coffee?
Yes. I drink a lot more tea than coffee, but I do drink coffee. I like the Cuban, the little espresso coffee maker.
Is that like your first drink and then you switch to tea?
No, my first drink is tea.
Oh. Oh, wow. And you drink your coffee like midday?
Around 9. Yes.
Okay.
I have the tea first. Yeah. 2 cups of tea, then the coffee.
Nice. I've not had someone who does tea first and then switches to coffee. That's fun. What's your tea? What's your morning tea?
I am very picky. I have it's always a black tea. So either an English breakfast, an Assam, a French breakfast, something, but it's always a black tea.
Loose leaf or bag?
I'm not going to lie. I'm not of the age. I have loose leaf tea. I own
support
it.
That. I used to be a tea drinker before I was a coffee drinker. And then I switched to coffee. So I know the tea life, the loose leaf life is real.
I love it. The loose leaf life. I'm writing that down. I'm living the loose leaf life.
it just tastes better. I mean, it's just that simple. And there's so many theories, you know, with like tea and bag teas and like the processing of whatever. And so listeners, if you want to drink tea, loose leaf tea is the way to go 100%.
And it's beautiful.
Yeah. Like watching the leaves. Yeah, it's great. Do you have a whole like diffuser? As you say, Yemen?
I have the little canastita that goes in the teapot.
Mm-hmm,
and so I just put it in there, set it for 4 minutes. It beeps. I take it out.
And then you go into your espresso.
Yes.
Okay.
But except I don't drink it as espresso. I foam up some almond milk, which as long as we're talking about it, I make. So it's more of like a little latte.
Yeah. I mean, you know, whatever works. And do you have a favorite coffee shop that you want to give a shout out to?
Yes. I live in Pasadena and my favorite coffee shop is Café de Leche on Lake Avenue. And they make beautiful coffee that is a blend of different Latino coffees, Mexican, Central American, South American, along with kind of U.S. coffees. So they make Café Campesino, which is, you know, like a café de olla because it has the cinnamon. And they make it as a espresso shot, as a latte. And then, you know, you can have, it's really beautiful.
I'm working on a Café con Pan tour.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, where I actually go visit coffee shops. That was the original idea from 7 years ago, but I didn't have the equipment or the capital. And now we saved some coins and bought a GoPro and We did a partnership with Nomono. It's a sound company, and we're on the tour, so we will add them to the list.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, I could also connect you to my student, former student, PhD student, Karina Santillano. She wrote her entire dissertation on Chicano coffee shops and what it means for Chicano. Oh my gosh, I can't believe, yes, it's just hitting me now. You must connect with Karina.
I would love to talk to her.
Chicano coffee shops, what it means for identity, what it means for place, what it means with social media, the way that we connect with them, what it meant during the pandemic. Yeah, it's really interesting.
I would love to talk to her. Okay, on my end, I am drinking pineapple ginger tea. I'm at my time of tea. I do coffee in the morning and I do tea in the afternoons. That's why I was like, I'm backwards from you. And I'm drinking pineapple ginger green tea. And I did like a mix because I am that person. I'm that person, literally. I drink, when I chew gum, I have to have two different flavors. When I do tea, I have to have two different flavors because I am that person. And so it's pineapple ginger that our friends from Tadin sent it to us.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get back to the show and continue your story. Hola, Manis. By the way, if you are enjoying this conversation and you want to keep talking about it, if you have some comments and maybe some questions that you have, follow me on social media and let's keep that conversation going. This is your reminder to screenshot and tag me at Café con Pan Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. And let's keep talking about it. Tell me what's resonating. Tell me what isn't. Tell me what do you wish I asked the guest. This is your chance. And if you're on TikTok, I'm at Café con Pan Pod as well. Let's stay connected. Okay. I have so many questions because you have such an extensive body of work and we're not going to have enough time. Like, we need to have 3 episodes with you.
We'll do one on the go with the GoPro.
Yeah. I'll come see you. Oh, we can meet at the coffee shop. Let's do that.
That sounds perfect.
Okay. So, just to fast forward, you go to school, you decide to go to school, and then you keep going.
That's a good way to put it. I think when you're Latino or, you know, first gen, second gen, it's this thing where your parents at the most assume, oh, you seem smart. You get good grades. You like books. Maybe you'll be a doctor. Maybe you'll be a lawyer. And so I kind of went in with that expectation. And I fell in love, or, you know, I really gained the storytelling tools as an undergraduate, doing women's studies, doing history. And I was that kid that went to office hours. And I say that because students go to office hours so much less now, I think because they're used to doing things on their phone or doing things virtually, or especially with the pandemic, you know, where they just didn't learn these things. I always encourage them to do that because you get so much free advice from the professors. You know, not everyone. Sometimes my students tell me some not nice stories. But basically, if you think your professor's nice in class, they're going to be extra nice in office hours. And so I just had a lot of professors tell me, why didn't you go to graduate school? And I'd say, what's that? And it was basically the school that taught you how to be a professor, where you learn your craft of whether it's literature or becoming an anthropologist or becoming a historian, as I did. And so luckily at that point, there was a program for first-gen students to help acclimate or to help them apply to graduate school. And I applied to that and I got in. Okay. And so everything was very much, there's a saying where you may not be able to see the whole road, but if you have your headlights on, you can see that bit of road ahead of you. And then once you get to the next point, then you see the next part. Mm-hmm. And so it was not very thoughtful at the same time. At least each next step was. I had some idea of what I was doing because of the program. I had some idea of what I was doing in my first year. And I just kind of took it one step at a time. And so that's how I ended up going to graduate school at the University of Michigan and getting a PhD.
And what was your PhD on?
I was always interested in the stories that we didn't tell amongst Latinos. So by the time I go to get my PhD in the 90s, there's been a cohort, even two cohorts of Latino scholars before me. So there's the first cohort in mainly in the 80s that are really doing the groundwork of what does it mean to have a community? How did people build community? And these are people like Ricardo Romo, who's a professor in Texas. These are people like Al Camarillo, who's recently retired from Stanford, that were digging up city directories, that were combing through newspapers, just trying to even get a sense of how many Latinos were there in these different cities. Did they have any associations? Where did they work? Like very nuts and bolts, what we call social history. Then you have the people that, what we say that they trained them, right, that studied with them. People like Vicky Ruiz, who retired as a dean at UC Irvine. People like George Sanchez, who was Al Camarillo's student at Stanford, who worked on Boyle Heights and wrote a book, Becoming Mexican American. And they were doing also that social, cultural work, saying, well, how did people feel about it? Like a lot of the questions that you're asking, right? Like, what was their identity? How was their identity as second gen different than first gen? What did it mean to be a woman at this time period? You know, all these different kinds of questions. And so then by the time I go in, I'm like, all that has been wonderful. We still don't have a lot on women. And so I really wanted to write a dissertation that was about Latina women and community formation. And I thought that I could do that by looking at midwives and parteras, because I thought, well, those are roles that women would need. And the records just didn't really exist. But the way that I ended up kind of getting at the topic more from what I call the top down, what we call the top down, kind of the institutional view, was through the people that were interacting with those women. So health officials, reformers, people saying, you're not doing that right when it comes to child rearing, child birthing, community formation. You know, these are the ways that you need to do it and you need to Americanize. Or now it's the depression and you don't. Now you just need to leave the country. So my dissertation, which became my first book is called Fit to Be Citizens, Public Health and Race in Los Angeles, was looking at those communities, how the narratives of Mexicans and the policies developed to work with them formed around public health. And public health is interesting because you think, whoa, shouldn't she be talking about immigration? She's talking about immigrants. But there's lots of ways that we discipline, demean, define immigrant communities, not just through immigration, but through institutions like public health, like schools, like the law.
And how have you seen those change from then to now? Have they?
There's a few ways in which they've changed and a few ways in which they haven't. So as, you know, we have these next generation, second, third, all of that, you see the ways in which these fields become more diversified. And so you have, you know, community health clinics, you have people that are really trying to work on these issues by learning with the community. You also have a lot of that coming out of social movements, you know, the Black Panthers. People think, oh, the Black, you know, Black Panthers, oh, wow, you know, this like paramilitary group, like, you know, standing up and, you know, saying they're going to defend their community by any means necessary and all of that. I mean, they had health clinics. They gave away free lunches. You know, a lot of their, you know, I'm doing air quotes here, demands were about, let's make sure our community has their basic needs met. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, if you don't work on the pipelines of people getting into these professions, and you have to kind of work your way back and say, are we educating our young people? Are they graduating high school? Are they graduating high school with the things they need, the tools they need, the SATs, the classes, the AP scores, all of that to get into colleges? Are we helping them so that they aren't crushed by the debt that college imposes on people? And this is very structural, right? The structure of that has changed. When I was in college, we had things called grants where if you were a certain income level, the government granted you the money. That all changed in the late 80s. And so if those people aren't in the pipeline to be in these jobs, it means that you also get to the point that there could be all that goodwill, all that awareness. We can talk about this all we want, and still Latino are sorely underrepresented in the healthcare profession. And not just as a whole, but even if you go to a Latino neighborhood. My mom's now 90, and trying to get her the care she needs with people that understand her cultural needs is very difficult.
Even now, 2023.
Absolutely. And we see it, you know, with other communities as well. We see it with the African-American community. So it's not just a language barrier. It's also dealing with things like microaggressions and implicit bias and believing people when they tell you their story, seeing them as reliable narrators, especially when they're talking about their own bodies.
Oof, we can go deep in there. And so what I'm hearing is we need to have various roles in the system. You know, the people that look at the history and write about it, but also the people that become the doctors and support the people and like all layers of it. And unfortunately, because the way that the system has been built, there's still a lot of barriers of entry for folks because like I didn't get grants. I got like maybe one scholarship probably. And so what have you seen from then to like, given that like there were grants back then and now they're like maybe like there are scholarships, but it takes just a lot more work to get to them. I didn't have any knowledge about scholarships, for example. There's a lot of content creators now that I've seen that talk about it more and more. So have you noticed a shift of us giving us more doors open?
That system still relies on people as individuals and sharing knowledge and spending the time doing that. And it doesn't compare with something that's structural, with something that's built into the cake of like, we are not going to accept that, you know, an average year at a college, once you take into account room and board, is going to be X times, you know, what a working class person's salary is, even a middle class person, right? I mean, if you're middle class, that's challenging in its own way, because you don't have enough money to pay an extra, basically run an extra household.
Literally.
You know, literally.
Yeah.
As well, you don't have the money for that, but you also don't qualify for the financial aid. And so you're just stuck in this middle.
Yeah. And there's also the various identities. You know, you have the immigrant, you have the first gen, and then you have DACA students, and you have like, there's so many layers there.
Ooh. Yes. Yes. And then that means that, you know, with mixed status families, and it's not just that you don't have access to grants, financial aid, and scholarships, you might not have access to jobs as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so even much. On a campus. So you could be a student on a campus, but you might have to pay out of state tuition, and you might not be eligible for a job there. So how many people are actually going to do that? Like, they can see as many Instagram posts as they like, being inspired and how to do this, but structurally, they're not going to be able to take advantage of these sources.
Oh. So what's the solution? Is there one?
I mean, part of it is, you know, what we've been trying to do for so long is, you know, just see Latinos, immigrants, undocumented as people. And once you embrace this radical concept that they're people and they're not just here to work, and that maybe they need to find a foothold in society like everybody else, then let's let them do things that will allow them to do that, like go to school and work and have opportunities and be human, have joy, have coffee.
I know. I agree. Oh, tell me about your next book, The Silent Hands That Shaped the Huntington, A History of Its Mexican Workers.
I am always interested in those stories that are there, but we aren't taught to see. We aren't trained to see. And so the Huntington Library Arts and Gardens is in San Marino, California. next to, you know, Pasadena adjacent. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful institution that's been here for over 100 years. I encourage everybody to come here if you come visit Los Angeles, Pasadena. And it's also one that we don't usually think of the labor that went into building it. And so Henry Huntington was a railroad magnate, an urban railway magnate, and used that money to open this museum. It was his home. It was converted into a museum after his passing. And most of the workers who built it were immigrants. The ones who worked in the fields and in the gardens, most of them were Mexicans. And so it's a way of saying, what if we looked at institutions and places not through the lens of the person whose name is on the building or the park or whatever it may be, but the resources, the human resources, the labor resources, the racial capital, you know, how people got their money, because it's not just the actual hands that built the money. It's the hands that led to the money.
Yes.
that paid for these places, where people got the land. And so it's forcing us to contend with that labor. We've seen this increasingly when it comes to slave labor, that certain institutions, you know, universities, University of Virginia has a monument to this, the White House that is built by slave labor. And yet we haven't quite come to terms with it for undocumented labor, immigrant labor. We're used to them always being the immigrant, always the labor, but never the citizen.
Oof, so much. And it makes me think, even for me, that I have an interest in real estate, and I always tell people, like, let's buy the block back. I think it's important to consider also the history of the foundation of that land, like you mentioned. And I mean, I'm like, I own an investment property, for example, and I'm curious, like, I've always been curious since I bought it, like, who lived here and who were the first owners and where do they come from? And, you know, what does this land mean? And so that's awesome. So it's going to make us think a lot more about the resources that we use.
Yes. I'm definitely most interested in the story from the perspective of giving people new ways of seeing, as much as, if not more than, the actual history of the Huntington, which there's actually few books on it. And it is always told through the story of Henry Huntington, or like the great art and the wealth. And this is really amazing because it is a library. And so, you know, hundreds of researchers come here every year. They have a fellowship program, and yet we don't know the actual history of the place itself.
Wow. The hands that built it. I love that. When can we expect this to come out?
I am working on it now. And so hopefully within a couple of years, in terms of by the time it's done and then, you know, goes through the whole process.
Oh my gosh. So exciting. Okay. So where can we find you these days? Where do you teach?
I'm at the University of Southern California. I also have a newsletter you could sign up for at nataliamolinaphd.com. And that is where I always share news about great conversations like we had today. And things that I write, like today, I published a piece in the LA Times that's a love letter to my tía Vicky's tamales. I say that they're our heartstrings back to our home state of Nayarit, our homeland that I'm not even technically from. And yet, yeah. Right? It's like, oh my gosh, you know, these tamales are the most important thing. We've always had them. And it's like, well, actually, you know, because all my aunts now are in their 80s and eventually those tamales are not going to be made. And, you know, what
do
will
you know how to do them?
I mean, it's not so much knowing, it's you have to want to put aside 3 days of your life.
Yes.
And make 400 tamales.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not just about making them. It's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's also trying to, that article that I just published in the LA Times is also trying to make visible women's labor around the tamalada.
Yes.
Yes. So, yes, I do that with the newsletter. And then, you know, on socials, prof_NataliaM.
All your books, we can find them on your site, on your blog?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And if we wanted to take one of your classes, we would have to be enrolled.
Yes.
Okay.
But the news, I share a lot in the newsletter.
The newsletter.
So that's another way.
I like the newsletter.
And then on the book website through the University of California Press, if you're an educator, I have lesson plans, I have assignments, I have all that. So that making the teaching books, making the teaching of the books a little bit easier, because educators are always, you know, having to prepare new materials, and I want to ease that.
I love that. I remembered I read somewhere that there was an ad for the restaurant in Nayarit.
Yes.
How did that happen?
You know, here, I was actually going to write a note to myself, like, I should actually have a little list next to me when I get interviewed, like, of where people can find me. It's always what people ask, and I always forget. And my grandmother was so far ahead of me in this, because she put an ad in her paper, the home state of Nayarit, for her restaurant in Los Angeles. So here she is saying, not only is she trying to get the LA crowd, she's trying to get the, you know, crowd that can visit from Mexico. And she's like, if you ever come to LA, let me tell you about the best Mexican restaurant. And what she says in it is not only, you know, she talks about the food and the decor and how wonderful it is, but she says, and you'll be waited on by people like yourselves.
Wow.
Mexicans who speak Spanish, and you will feel comfortable. So she also understands that there's the need to help people feel at ease. And to me, what's so interesting about that is, for, you know, African-American history, the Green Book is so important. The Green Book that let African-Americans know, if you're traveling, these are the restaurants that are safe to go to. These are the hotels. This is where you can get gas. Because if not, you could risk mm-hmm. being discriminated against at best, and even experience violence. And so to me, the newspaper El Eco was kind of like a Latino Green Book, because people would send, right, you know, take out ads, people would send little messages. It's almost like a pre-Facebook. Wow. Where they're like, hey, I'm in LA, if you come by, come visit me.
That's awesome.
Yes.
How long did you run the ad, you know?
It's only in a few issues, but they have this special anniversary news issue that comes out less as a newspaper and more of a magazine, and people kept those editions. And she'd always run an ad in the anniversary edition, to the point that when I started doing research, I was having trouble finding traces of working class Mexicans from Nayarit in Spanish language newspapers like La Opinion. And then one day it hit me, oh, what if I actually look at the paper in Mexico? So to study LA, I had to use these Mexican newspapers, which meant going to Mexico. And there's a library for these newspapers, you know, for all kinds. And yet when I was interviewing people, they're like, oh, we have a stack of them. Like, decades later, people kept them. They were almost like yearbooks. Like, you just wouldn't throw them away.
That's awesome. And that's a way to preserve history as well.
Yes. And that people kept their own archives, right? They're not seeing their stories out there in the world. So they kept these special issues, anniversary issues of the newspaper.
I love that. Yeah. All stories need to be told. 100%. I'm with you. Profesora Molina, thank you for being here at Café con Pam. Last few questions. Do you have a remedio that you want to share with us?
My remedio is the power of meditation. I started meditating almost 10 years ago. I tried to do it on my own. I'm someone who's very much into outer accountability. So I finally took a workshop on it. And there's no other way to say it changed my life. It really just helped me see, you know, we've spoken so much about stories in this podcast, but meditation really helps you see the stories that you're telling yourself in your head. We're so often living in the past or the future, not often in the present.
Yes.
Not often connecting like you and I have during this interview, and just really being in one place. So the power of meditation.
Yeah, I love tying it back to the inner story, you know, because it's not only the outer story, but it's also the story they would tell ourselves. I love that. Well done. And what's your quote or mantra that you live by today, tomorrow, this chapter?
I use the quote, what's yours is yours, what's mine is mine. And that comes from meditation. And that's a way of really helping us focus on what we own and what we're responsible for. Because if you're a woman in today's society, you are taught at a young age that you're responsible for many things, including people's feelings, caretaking. And if you are always in that role, you're never getting to get your own stuff done. Mm-hmm. So what's yours is yours. What's mine is mine. It's a very compassionate way of saying, like, I see you over there and I see you may need that. And I'm not the person to help you right now.
Yes. I love that. And it also, you know what I thought of when you mentioned it earlier in our conversation, you talked about your grandma also like seating for other people's restaurants. And I think we can still see a little bit in our culture, the envidia, you know, like, oh no, I don't want to share. And so I love that what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours, because it's like, you know, it's kind of like el sol sale para todos type thing.
Yes. Well, and you mentioning her, a lot of people ask me, like, did you hear stories about her as being like warm and fuzzy? And did she love to do that? I'm like, all my grandmother did was work. Basically, her grandkids would come see her at the restaurant. Like, that was her thing.
Wow.
And to me, she must have had some version of what's yours is yours, what's mine is mine. She just didn't worry about all those other gendered roles. She's like, I'm going to run a restaurant. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do it as best as possible. I'm glad that I can help people with it. And I don't need to go home and cook for you then and then like host you in this way and be this warm and fuzzy grandma. This is my thing and I'm going to do it really well.
Yes, I love that. And last but not least, do you have a productivity tip, trick, or tool that you want to share with us?
As much as I love storytelling, storytelling can be challenging because you cannot wait to be motivated to tell your stories.
Yes.
And even when you have time and you want to, sometimes storytelling can be scary. And so one of the tools that helps me is the Pomodoro technique. And Pomodoro refers to, you know, a tomato in Italian. And that's because the original Pomodoro, you use a timer that was shaped in a tomato. I just use my phone now.
Yeah.
And you set it for 25 minutes. But, you know, if you're new to it, you can start with 5 or 10 or whatever you have time for. And it's just letting you know, I don't need to write forever. I'm just going to hold space for this. And you don't even need to write for 25 minutes. Mm. But I need to be to sit here and be in the present, going back to meditation, and just sit with this story and be curious about it and lean into it for 25 minutes. Words may end up on the page. They may not. But I'm going to sit here and be present with this story for 25 minutes.
I love that. I did that with a client the other day because she was getting stuck in like writing a story. And we brainstormed for 5 minutes.
Oh.
And so I was like, let's just brainstorm it out. You know, there's no right or wrong. Just spit whatever comes out. Some of it might be great. Some of it might be trash. We don't have to use it, but it's just getting you, you know, flowing into it. And then after that, she was like, all right, that was kind of like a good warm up. So I love that.
Okay. Yes, exactly. That's a great example.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming to Café con Pam. This was awesome.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Listeners, stay shining.
All right, listeners, that was a conversation with Professora Natalia Molina. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I know you probably have a lot more questions, and perhaps you're going to head over to get the book or her 3 books and read more. I think what's important about distinguished professors, people in academia, to write these books is to give us not only to leave their legacy behind, but also to give us access to that information. To those of us who may never take a lecture from her or be in the universities that they lecture, it's really awesome to be able to acquire a piece of their knowledge in the form of a book. And as a Latina author, I think we must also support that. you know, I'm a big advocate for buying books authored by Latine and people of the global majority, because we need those books to be on shelves more. And the more we buy, the more we show that we care and we want more of that information. Let me know what you think. Screenshot, tag this, tag me on the socials. I'm taking a small, I frankly don't know how long, but I'm taking a hiatus from social media. I basically just go and post about the episodes because I have to. Other than that, I'm really not on there because I have taken not only a much needed time off in this last few weeks, but also I've taken the time, the scrolling time, to educate myself, to have conversations, to learn more about what's happening in the world and go inward a lot more, because I think it's necessary for us to absolutely acknowledge what's happening and at the same time discern when it's the time to step in and step back. And so in my case, if you're wondering like, oh, she just disappeared, it's because I've deliberately taken the time to have the conversations that a lot of people are having on social media within my circle, within the Manis community. We've been having a lot of talks and that's where I've been. But still tag me if you feel called. I do go get the notifications, and when people do tag me, I do repost or reshare on the stories, because absolutely I will respond to that totally. I'm just not actively sharing or sharing about me so much. I kind of started a writing also, and I might continue that because it's been quite fun. So do tag on the socials at Cafe Con Pan Podcast. Also, if this is your first time here, thank you so much for being here. I so appreciate it. If you are watching the video, we are now on YouTube. If you are not yet, come to the YouTube. Just look for Cafe Con Pan. We show up. We are building our YouTube channel, and I am working on more and more content on YouTube than what shows up in the podcast. Mucho más contenido en español va a salir en el YouTube channel. Y I'm also doing a coffee shop tour. Those interviews are going to drop on the YouTube channel. So definitely head over and subscribe. Cafe con Pan on YouTube. If you feel called to leave a rating and a review. If you feel called on the YouTube to leave a comment, thank you so much. So appreciate it. And that's it for me today. If you want a quick update, I just got back to San Diego after traveling for 2 weeks and lots to catch up on. Look at my mail. This is all the mail that I have to, that I have to check. Pero bueno. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. Happy 2024, whatever that means. May we continue to find that which moves us and connects us. Como siempre, stay shining.